All right, in our study of Deuteronomy, we've come to chapter 9. Maybe a little bit longer than the chapters that have preceded it. I'll read the whole thing. Hear, O Israel, you are to cross over the Jordan today and go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than yourself. Cities great and fortified up to heaven, a people great and tall, the descendants of the Anakim, whom you know, and of whom you heard it said, who can stand before the descendants of Anak? Therefore understand today that the Lord your God is he who goes over before you as a consuming fire. He will destroy them and bring them down before you. So you shall drive them out and destroy them quickly, as the Lord has said to you. Do not think in your heart, after the Lord has cast out them before you, has cast them out before you, saying, because of my righteousness, the Lord has brought me in to possess this land. But it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out from before you. It is not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you go in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God drives them out from before you, and that he may fulfill the word which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Therefore understand that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stiff-necked people. Remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day that you departed from the land of Egypt until you came to this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord. Also in Horeb you provoked the Lord to wrath, so that the Lord was angry enough with you to have destroyed you. When I went up into the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant which the Lord made with you, then I stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water. Then the Lord delivered to me 2 tablets of stone written with the finger of God, and on them were all the words which the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly. And it came to pass at the end of 40 days and 40 nights that the Lord gave me the 2 tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Then the Lord said to me, arise, go down quickly from here, for your people whom you have brought out of Egypt have acted corruptly. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded image. Furthermore, the Lord spoke to me, saying, I have seen this people, and indeed they are a stiff-necked people. Let me alone that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven. And I will make of you a nation mightier and greater than they. So I turned and came down from the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire, and the 2 tablets of the covenant were in my 2 hands. And I looked, and behold, you had sinned against the Lord your God, had made for yourselves a molded calf. You had turned aside quickly from the way which the Lord had commanded you. Then I took the 2 tablets and threw them out of my 2 hands and broke them before your eyes. And I fell down before the Lord as at the first, 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all your sin which you committed in doing wickedly in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure with which the Lord was angry with you to destroy you. But the Lord listened to me at that time also. And the Lord was very angry with Aaron and would have destroyed him. So I prayed for Aaron also at the same time. Then I took your sin, the calf which you had made, and burned it with fire and crushed it and ground it very small until it was as fine as dust. And I threw its dust into the brook that descended from the mountain. Also at Taberah and Massah and Kibroth Hattaava, you provoked the Lord to wrath. Likewise, when the Lord sent you from Kadesh Barnea, saying, go up and possess the land which I have given you, then you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God, and you did not believe him, nor obey his voice. You have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. Thus I prostrated myself before the Lord. 40 days and 40 nights I kept prostrating myself, because the Lord had said he would destroy you. Therefore I prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord God, do not destroy your people and your inheritance, whom you have redeemed through your greatness, whom you have brought out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Do not look on the stubbornness of this people or on their wickedness or their sin, lest the land from which you brought us should say, because the Lord was not able to bring them to the land which he promised them, And because he hated them, he has brought them out to kill them in the wilderness. Yet they are your people and your inheritance, whom you brought out by your mighty power and by your outstretched arm. Okay, so I guess I remind you every week, but we're in the section of Deuteronomy where Moses is giving an exposition of the law, and especially focusing on the first commandment, the obligation to worship only God, no other God. And we saw last week how that was worked out specifically in the way they would be tempted to trust in their own ability, to be self-confident in their ability to produce wealth. We saw in verse 17 of chapter 8, they would say, "My power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth." God warned them against that and wanted them to remember the lesson of the manna. And this week, if you want to connect it with last week, it is that they shouldn't trust in their own righteousness. Just as they shouldn't have self-confidence in their own ability to produce wealth, they shouldn't have self-confidence in terms of their own righteousness. Instead, they should look to God, trust in God and His covenant mercies. I thought Calvin put the combination of those two well when he says, "For God is not less defrauded of His glory when men oppose their righteousness to His liberality than when they boast that whatever blessings they have obtained, they have are obtained by their own industry." So both are an insult to God, to say that we can be self-sufficient, whether in terms of our material well-being or in terms of our spiritual well-being, in terms of our righteousness. Both are an insult to God. So this chapter is longer, but there really is one main point that he works out. He wants to convince them that they shouldn't believe that they gained the land because of their righteousness. So he hammers away at them for like 23 verses on how instead they're stiff-necked. Okay, you may have caught that. That's the main part of the chapter is, oh, you were wicked with the golden calf, you're wicked here, you're wicked there. In case you didn't miss it, you're wicked there also. And therefore, you're not gaining the land by your own righteousness. So, you know, one is tempted to, if they rate movies, you could rate this chapter is I for insulting or something like that, because it does, you know, it trashes our ancestors, it trashes us, if you want to look at it that way. But there is a good end, and it's not simply that he convinces them of their own stiff-necked, rebellious ways, but also God's gracious provision to receive them, and especially here, receive them because of a mediator. So we'll look at that as the last of the points. But let's go back just to some of the introductory material. The first six verses here, God again assures them that they will have victory. They will dispossess the nations, he says in verse 1. And he reminds them of what a tremendous obstacle they face. Okay, so these Anakim, the cities that would be great and fortified in verse 1, those were exactly the things that caused them to turn away at Kadesh Barnea 40 years ago. But God is saying, you're going to have victory because of my work. And God says he will go over before them as a consuming fire. Okay, so that the fire that devours the enemy is the thing that gives them encouragement. He will drive them out and destroy them quickly, he says. So the background is the victory that God will give them. So that's assured. They are going to conquer the land. But the warning is that they shouldn't think that God is doing this for them because of their own righteousness. Okay, so you should understand, it may seem like sort of a fine point here, but the question isn't whether they're going to conquer the land in their own strength or not. Okay? That's an agreed point in this discussion. Okay, they're going to do it in God's strength. But the question is, why is God enabling them to do this? And the thing that they could be tempted to do once they settled in the land was to think, wow, I must be really good the way God honored me and gave me this land. So it's similar to the temptation last week, right, of confidence in their own ability to produce wealth because, well, God gave them the land, and look, they're wealthy, so they must have produced it themselves. So it's a similar sort of temptation. But God wants to disabuse them of this idea. We might say he does it to an extreme, but notice even in verses 4, 5, and 6 how often he says that. Do not think that the Lord is giving them the land because of my righteousness, Verse 5, it is not because of your righteousness of the uprightness of your heart. Verse 6, the Lord is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness, for you are a stiff-necked people. Okay, by the image of the stiff-necked person, my neck is stiff most days these days, but has to do with the oxen that won't go the way you're trying to get them to go. So this, the idea is stubbornness. And so God emphasizes up front that it's not because of their righteousness, and then he says straight out it's rather the opposite in terms of who you are. You're a stiff-necked people. But if it's not because of their righteousness, why is it that God is bringing them into the land? Well, this is a point that's already been covered several times in Deuteronomy. So it is because of the wickedness of the nations in verse 4. We've talked about that more than once. The Canaanites were repulsive. The iniquity was full after some 400 years from the time of the word to Abraham. And again, it says in verse 5, the terms of fulfilling the covenant, fulfilling the word which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So positively, he rehearses briefly the reasons why he did give them the land. But negatively, and that's the focus of the chapter, is the reason why he didn't give them the land. Lest they think it was because of their righteousness, he says again and again, it's not because of your righteousness. Now, you know, last week we were talking about bread. Everyone understands bread. We need bread every day, that sort of thing. This may seem a little distant to us, right? We're not about to conquer any land, and why should we care whether they thought they were righteous because of that? But one point to remember is just the typological significance of the land. We talked about this early on. The land is, for example, in Hebrews, used to represent the eternal inheritance. And so that should, in our minds, make that connection between the land that they were to enter and trust in your own righteousness to the way we are accepted before God for the most important question of whether we will inherit the new heavens and the new earth. And that connection is made well by Calvin again. Sorry, I have a lot of quotes from Calvin today. But he says here, true it is that Moses speaketh here of the land of Canaan, but if men cannot deserve anything in this world in respect of transitory things, how shall they deserve everlasting life? If I cannot win a little piece of ground, how shall I win a whole realm? And then he goes on to say, if the children of Israel were put in possession of the land that had been promised them, not for their own righteousness, but through God's free goodness, it is much more reason that when we speak of the heavenly life and the inheritance of the heavenly glory, we should not dream upon any power of our own, but acknowledge that God has uttered his righteousness and shown his goodness in deigning to choose us. That connection I'm not going to dwell on, but I hope you remember when we studied it in Romans, wasn't that long ago. So for example, in Romans 10, 6, the Apostle Paul is saying that the nation of Israel sought acceptance with him by the law, and they failed. That's why they failed when seeking God, because they sought acceptance by the law instead of by faith. And to clinch that argument, in Romans 10:6, he echoes two Old Testament passages. One of them is here, do not think in your heart in terms of your own righteousness. And the rest of it is in Deuteronomy 30, 12 through 14. So the connection is made explicitly by the Apostle Paul to this tendency. Now, he's especially addressing the Jews, but I think it's a common tendency. This tendency to think of God as somehow obligated to receive us because of our righteousness. And what a fatal error that is. In a similar way, in Titus 3, 4, and 5, he says, not because of righteous deeds that we have done, but because of his own mercy that he has received us. So I hope as we go through this, you won't think just of those stubborn Israelites who were impressed with their own goodness, but realize that this tendency to trust in our righteousness, to believe because we are in church or because we do this or that, that somehow it's because of our righteousness that we have these privileges. And that's a very common temptation to all ages. Okay, so then the next part is the part that's rated I. If you want to leave the room or something, it's okay. You're about to be insulted. Any comments or questions so far?
No.
Samuel wants to make a phone call. Okay.
Alan, just, yeah. This is about something more at the beginning, but
this contrast between we earned it our, we built this ourselves, we earned it.
Yeah.
Is that God has favored us because we're good and so we got it, or what's the other sort of? I was a little unclear on what the other error was. You read the quote from Calvin.
Yeah.
I didn't quite process the middle phrase that had the.
Okay. They are going to come into the land, and they're going to think that God gave them the land because of their righteousness. Right, so that's the error. It's agreed that God gave them the land, that they didn't earn it in their own strength. But the question is why he favored them particularly. And the answer in their mind would be, we're better than the Canaanites. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we earned it in a different way.
Yeah. Right, I mean, God gave it to us, but because we deserved it, sort of, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. And the reason, by the way, the reason Calvin makes that point specifically is that the controversy with the Roman Catholic Church wasn't specifically about whether God is gracious in salvation. So they agreed that God is gracious in enabling us to do good works. But the point of contention was whether those good works were part of the basis for our justification. So it's not exactly the same sort of contrast, but it's an important distinction that why Calvin wanted to make that point there. It's an important distinction for justification also. It's whether everyone agrees that God accepts us, but the question is it because he accepts the works that he does in us as righteous, or whether it's for the merits of another completely.
Thinking about this question of sort of presuming on God, like I can sin because I'm
God. Yeah. Right. No, and I think ultimately, in terms of how it serves the larger purpose of this section in Deuteronomy, the first commandment, you know, I am the Lord your God, it does turn us away from complete acknowledgement of God's mercy to a kind of, well, he's got to be impressed with me so I can do a few things that'll make me happy kind of thing. Yeah, that's right. Very good. Yep. Okay. So yeah, the second section, then verses 7 through 24, he spells out why he says you are a stiff-necked people. Okay? And he has hard historical evidence. Okay, there's no escaping this. The passage, verses 7 through 24, is actually bracketed. It's called an inclusio when people look at the literary things by the phrase from the day that I knew you, or that's in verse 24, or in verse 7, from the day that you departed from Egypt. So both of those phrases are there to indicate that this is a habitual sin. This is characteristic of them, to rebel against God. And by the way, when Moses says in verse 24, from the day that I knew you, it's not like, you know, ever since you were a kid, I remember you always, you know, used to throw rocks through windows and that sort of thing. The explanation that I saw that seemed most helpful to me was that Moses is there declaring himself as a witness. Okay, he has been, as it were, a witness to the violation of the covenant. And he has seen what they have done. And that seems to be the point of what he's saying here. Okay, so at the beginning then, in verse 7, Moses says, remember and do not forget. Now this phrase, this call to remember, is, we saw it last week in chapter 8, and it recurs in Deuteronomy. And it is supposed to be for us a reminder of a certain amount of not only self-reflection, but on reflection of who we are as the people of God. We tend to forget our history and God's mercy to us if we don't think of what God has done to us and who we have been. And so the call here at the beginning, remember and do not forget, well, they're going to be helped along. He's going to remind them. But it is also a call to think on what Moses tells them. Now, this sort of historical survey of the rebelliousness of the people is something that you can find elsewhere. It does identify the people who are standing on the borders of Canaan with their forefathers. So it's always, you did this, you did that. The individual might say, well, I wasn't there 40 years ago. I wasn't there at Sinai. But this is something that's characteristic of the people of God. That's the idea. And that reference to the sins of the fathers and to learning from the sins of the fathers, we can find, well, we sing of it in the Psalms, so I put down two, Psalm 78 and Psalm 106. Paul in 1 Corinthians 10 says, remember about our fathers and what they did in the wilderness, and he specifically refers to the incident of the golden calf, which occupies most of what we're going to be looking at. So it is, I joked about it, but it is, you know, it is sort of insulting. Like, why would we spend time thinking about how terrible we and our ancestors have been? Well, we'll see the reason for it. It serves the major point, which is to disabuse them of the ideas of their own righteousness and God regarding them because of that. But let me just make the comment that this has often been used, and I think rightly so, as a evidence of the historical accuracy and even of the divine inspiration of this. I mean, if you were writing your family history, would you say, oh yeah, let's put down the time Grandpa shot Grandma in the head. That would be good. And how about the crazy aunt that we locked up? Let's put that in there too. Well, no. Of course, if you wanted to write an embellished history, you wouldn't include those things. But God not only includes them in Exodus, but rehearses them in Deuteronomy, and then has his people sing about them in Psalm 78 and 106, okay? And then reminds them in the New Testament. Okay, obviously there's a point to it, but it isn't an indication that the Bible isn't like one of these dressed-up histories which only tells us the nice parts. But instead, it is God's word to us, and it's a merciful thing that he does this. Okay, so looking specifically at the description, the main focus, as I said, is on what happened, as it says here in verse 8, in Horeb, or Mount Sinai. Okay, most of the description is occupied with the rebellion at Horeb when they made the golden calf. Okay, there's a little bit at the end, verse 22, Tabra and Massa and Kibroth Hatava and Kadesh Barnea. We'll come to those places just briefly. But as you can see just by the space between verse 8 and verse 22, most of it's about that. All right, so you remember the incident. Moses was on the mountain. He was receiving further revelation from God. And just as he had been given the tablets on which God had written the Ten Commandments, God says, you better go down because the people have rebelled against me and they've made a golden calf. Okay, so this is spelled out in Exodus 32. And what's here is largely a summary of Exodus 32. There is some information actually that's not in Exodus 32, like about the Lord being angry with Aaron. I guess one might have guessed, given Aaron's weaselly sort of response, out came this calf, that, you know, the Lord might be angry with him. But largely it's a summary of what was described in Exodus 32. And the emphasis in this passage, and the reason this is put forth and highlighted, is the enormity of the sin. Okay? Think about it. You just had God revealing himself in flashes of fire and lightning. You had God speaking the Ten Commandments to you. And Moses, your great leader, goes up on the mountain. And you start looking at your watch and say, it's been a long time since we've seen Moses. Why don't we make gods for us? And at first it's going to be a god, the God who brought us out of Egypt. It's going to be a molten calf to represent the Lord. And then like 5 minutes later, it's suddenly, you know, the gods that brought us out of Egypt, and it's idol worship. They have exchanged the glory of God for an image of God, for an idol. And the passage highlights that. Moses, you see in verse 9, was in the presence of God. Moses was fasting. He was sustained 40 days and 40 nights without bread. Well, people can fast that long, not much longer, but also without water, which requires the divine work in a special way to preserve Moses' life. So Moses was communing with God. Moses was keeping, you might say, the first commandment. And what were they doing? They were violating the first commandment. They were instead rebelling against God. So it's described in verse 12, they have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. And in fact, the passage emphasizes the fact that it was quickly done. They turned away from God in a way that was most stunning. Now, of course, the implication of this is that they're not a righteous nation. Okay, they're a stiff-necked nation. And in case you missed that point, just notice verse 14. The Lord says to Moses, let me alone that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven. You may remember from, where was the reference? Sorry, I lost it here. From chapter 7. Okay, so it wasn't last week, a couple of weeks ago, that it said that God will deliver the kings of Canaan into your hand and you will destroy their name from under heaven. In other words, they had, by this rebellion, been liable to the same judgment as the Canaanites. They had, in effect, by breaking the covenant, become Canaanites or worse. So it wasn't a righteous nation, in fact. It was a rebellious nation. That was supposed to be what they realized. Now, Moses, in receiving the Ten Commandments and hearing the word from God in verse 12, "Arise and go down quickly," realized their danger. I mean, they didn't realize it, but Moses recognized the difficult position they were in. And it says in verse 19, "I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure with which the Lord was angry with you to destroy you." Verse 20, "The Lord was very angry with Aaron." So it wasn't a minor thing. That's the point I'm trying to emphasize from the passage. It was a serious thing. Moses realized the seriousness of it. And that's why Moses broke the tablets. Okay? He actually threw them down and broke them. The tablets were a representation of the covenant. In fact, the 10 words were called the covenant, as we saw earlier. And so by throwing down, this is verse 17, by taking them and throwing them and breaking them before your eyes, Moses was saying, in effect, as far as it lies in you, you have broken the covenant of God. You have so rebelled against them that you have broken his covenant. So it was a serious rebellion against God. And let me just mention, in connection with that, also the reference to Aaron one more time. The Lord was very angry with Aaron and would have destroyed him. Okay, obviously, I've already mentioned Aaron's part in this. He went along at first and then seemed to come up with some creative ways to make it look better. But it wasn't simply that. It was that Aaron was the one who was supposed to be making atonement for them. Okay? So if their high priest rebelled against God, what a terrible condition they were in. Right? So not simply Aaron as a person, but Aaron as the religious leader of the nation, you might say, under Moses, or however you want to look at it. He was the high priest. He was under the wrath of God, and therefore their condition was apparently hopeless. Now, that should be enough to convince them that they are a rebellious people. And I could spend more time on it, but, you know, then it would be rated worse than I. So we'll move on and just mention briefly the description of the other places. Some of these are familiar, some of them may not be familiar. So I put the references on the board. So Tabera, that's Numbers 11, 1 through 3. So Tabera means burning. At that point, they were complaining about their conditions. And Moses actually prayed for them and interceded to stop the burning, the fire that God sent among them. The second one is Massa, which maybe is more familiar, Massa or Meribah, the place where they, which means quarrel. They complained that there was no water, and Moses struck the rock. This was the first occasion in which water came out of the rock. So that's Exodus 17. So you get the idea here. They're complaining, they're quarreling, God is providing for them in the wilderness, but they're still rebelling against him. The next one is Kibroth Hattaava, which is described in Numbers 11, it's disappeared here, 31 through 35. That means something like tombs of lusting or tombs of desire. Okay, that was connected with the quail that God sent them, and they were so rebellious against God and so desirous of God's provision that God struck them down even while the food was in their mouth. It's a kind of a grim picture. But that's Kibroth Hattaava. And then the last one is Kadesh Barnea. We talked about that already in Deuteronomy. So that was when they were on the border of the Promised Land the first time from the south, and they said, this looks like something we don't really want to do. These people are too powerful for us. So they turned away from God. And it says specifically in verse 23, at that time, you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God. So the passage emphasizes, as we said throughout, and then even in the summary at the end, you have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you, to remind them that there was no reason why they should trust in their own righteousness. And in fact, it was worse than that. There was no reason why they should even be there, because God should have wiped them out at Mount Sinai. God could have wiped them out several times in between. Some of these were actually before appearing on Mount Sinai, like the Exodus 17 passage. But again and again, they rebelled against God. There was no reason why they should even be there, why they should inherit the land. So it would be foolishness to trust in their own righteousness. So I know Dan likes to say, you know, we talk about the 5 points, everything hangs on the T. Like, this is the T magnified. If you want, this is rated T instead of rated I. It's an emphasis on the fact that man naturally brings nothing before God to impress God. Instead, his tendency is to rebel against God. And even those who have been justified by God and are being sanctified have nothing that can merit acceptance with God. It's only by his grace that we're received. Okay. Now, the passage doesn't leave us there. And that's, I want to spend some time, it looks like I do have some time, to talk about the provision of a mediator. But you have any comments or questions on the middle part there, on the T part? Okay. Well, then let's look at the provision of a mediator. And here's the gracious provision of God. Here's the answer to the question of why they didn't perish at Sinai. And why they didn't perish earlier. It is because God is merciful, and specifically he shows that by the provision of Moses as a mediator. Now, I put together from different places a list of references of where Moses had mediated for the people, and it's maybe surprisingly long. Exodus 32:11-14, that's the parallel passage, but also in Exodus 34, Numbers 11, 12, and so on. Several times when the people are about to be destroyed because of their stiff-neckedness and rebelliousness, Moses intercedes for them. I think we're familiar with that idea, but I want to think about that a little bit here and how it fits in with the passage. The first thing we should notice is that Moses, as a mediator, didn't downplay the seriousness of their sin. Okay? So it's not as if he said, well, it wasn't really that bad. And, you know, you should just be kind to them because they really meant well. And you shouldn't destroy them because you're a nice God and you don't do things like that. Moses doesn't talk that way. In fact, I'm not sure if we want to hire him as our mediator if we knew what he was going to say. Because he says in the middle of his mediation for them, and the main part of it is toward the end of the chapter, remember your servants Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That sounds good. But then verse 27, do not look on the stubbornness of this people or on their wickedness or their sin. Okay, so Moses isn't downplaying the significance of their sin. And I mean, you can think about where we're going. Christ is the one whom Moses is only a small picture of. And it's important for us to remember that in the work of Christ, it's not as if sin is downplayed. It was the death of God's own Son that atoned for our sin. So Moses, as mediator, doesn't downplay their sin. And from a human point of view, it would be a very difficult position to be in, therefore, to say, this is a wicked people, but in essence, I'm going to risk my neck for it by interceding for them. So let's see some more of that. What does he actually say about them? As I mentioned, the main part of his mediation for them is described in verses 25 through 29. There are other statements, for example, in verse 14, and also again in verses 18 through 20. So I'll try to draw on all of those as we look at this. But in brief, God says to Moses, step aside, in effect. Let me alone that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven. Okay? And Moses' response to that is first described, as I said, in verses 18 through 20. I fell down before the Lord as at the first 40 days and 40 nights. I don't know if you ever thought about this, but Moses had just gone 40 days and 40 nights without food or water. He comes down the mountain. He sees them rebelling, and what does he do? He goes back for another 40 days without bread or water. It's a very striking way God sustained him. It connects well, actually, with what we were talking about last week. A man doesn't live by bread alone. Apparently, Moses didn't live by bread alone or even by water in the normal way. But Moses, in verses 18 through 20, talks about his response, and I've already mentioned much of that. So let's focus especially on verses 25 through 29, and I'll just make a specific point here. It says, "Thus I prostrated myself before the Lord 40 days and 40 nights." It looks a little confusing. Is this a third 40 days and 40 nights? Well, no, he's picking up what he had mentioned before. In the Hebrew way of writing things, you would sometimes mention something and then finish your train of thought and then come back to that thing. Okay. I interrupt myself all the time. So here he's coming back to what he had said before and spelling out what exactly he said to God. And it's really quite remarkable to see how does one approach God in a situation like this. Moses acknowledges their sin. He acknowledges that they deserve to be blotted out like the Canaanites. What arguments does he use against that? Well, first in verse 26, he recalls God's connection with the people. Now, it's specifically the covenant, but you might say the way God has worked out the covenant. O Lord God, verse 26, do not destroy your people and your inheritance, whom you have redeemed through your greatness, whom you have brought out of Egypt with a mighty hand. You've started this work, Lord, he says in effect. You have taken them as your inheritance. You have shown your power through Egypt. So complete your work. That's the implication of it. It's a beautiful idea that's brought up in Psalm 138, for example. Don't leave the work of your hand. And Philippians 1, a very similar idea. So that's one argument that Moses brings before the Lord. You've started this. You have brought them to yourself. So complete your work among them. The second, it's really hard to separate them out or to say they're only like two or three, or you could combine them. But the second in my counting is verse 27, remember your servants Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay? Now, he's not saying they were good, but these people are bad. It's like he's saying, remember your covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's already been made. That point has already been made at the beginning of the chapter. It was... We saw that in verse 5, the covenant or the word which you swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which the Lord swore to your fathers. So here he is saying, remember your covenant. Okay, your covenant is to take these people to be your own. So don't think of their merits, but think of your promises. Think of your mercy. That's the point of it. And then the third one is a really interesting argument. And that's in verse 28. Lest the land from which you brought us, that would be Egypt, should say, because the Lord was not able to bring them to the land which he promised them, and because he hated them, he has brought them out to kill them in the wilderness. One commentator called this like the most daring argument anyone could ever give before God. It is. You know, you might say it's a little dicey as an argument. I don't think that would be a good biblical word for it. But Moses apparently... was led to pray in this way. In essence, he's asking, God, think of your name. And there's nothing dicey about that. If you're thinking about God and about God's glory and the regard that God has for his name, you're on good ground. And that's basically the argument he's making here. But the way it seems a little odd to us, the reason it seems odd to us is because he's saying he wants his name to be regarded even among the heathen. Even among the Egyptians. So the Egyptians might say, well, God started the work. He brought them out of Egypt, but he couldn't finish it. So he just killed them before they entered the promised land. The Egyptians might say that. Or they might say, well, he loved them at first, but, you know, Jehovah of Israel is a fickle God. He changed his mind. And we understand why, because we didn't like them either. But, you know, he hated them in the end. Because he hated them, he brought them out to kill them in the wilderness. So those are the sorts of things that Moses brings before God. And it's a striking fact that you can see this pattern elsewhere in scriptures. And that is a regard that God's name not be blasphemed among the nations. Okay, that's really what the nation of Israel did, especially as they went into exile. So Moses is saying, Lord, let your name be sanctified even among the nations, even among the unbelievers. Have a regard to the greatness of your name. Now, in terms of the role that Moses has here, we should first of all be reminded that we should pray for each other. Okay? Now, that may seem like kind of a mild application. I'll get to Jesus as our mediator in a minute. But we should be reminded by this passage to pray for each other, especially those who are leaders in the church should be praying for those under their care. Okay? This is Moses praying for those who were given to him by God, and we should pray for them. But the passage is making a very weighty point in addition to that. In essence, the passage is saying, if we don't have a mediator, we're goners. We're destroyed. And that's the indirect implication of verse 14, let me alone that I may destroy them. And at first, that sounds like sort of a paradox. Why would you tell Moses to let me alone that I may destroy them, and then you listen to what Moses has to say? I mean, didn't Moses obey you? Shouldn't he just have let you alone? In essence, when God says to Moses, let me alone, he's saying, unless you intercede for them, I will destroy them. Okay? We tend to look at the passage and think of it, even if we wouldn't say it this way, as sort of a game. Of course, God really wasn't going to destroy the people. I mean, they sinned, but he wouldn't do a thing like that. But the point of the passage is, yes, he would. If there is not someone to stand in the place to plead with the people, they are to be destroyed. Don't downplay the significance of Moses' role. And just to see one instance of that, let's turn to Psalm 106. So, I guess, I'm not sure you need to keep your finger in Deuteronomy. We may look at other references after this too. Psalm 106, verse 23. So I mentioned Psalm 106 talks about the rebelliousness of the people. We've sung through this psalm before, you know, all the things that they did. Don't be like their fathers were, it starts out. So Psalm 106, verse 23, and this is, by the way, in the context, they made a calf in Horeb, that's verse 19, and worshiped the molded image. So this whole paragraph is about that account. And it says, verse 23, therefore he, the Lord, said that he would destroy them, had not Moses, his chosen one, stood before him in the breach to turn away his wrath, lest he destroy them. And so the idea is of a city walls. There's a gap in the city walls. And so the defenses are weakened. And we need a champion to stand in the wall, like, you know, the Goliath the champion kind of guy. We need someone there to stand in the breach to protect the people. And the point is that he would have destroyed them if Moses hadn't stood in the breach. That's the point of the passage is, you think you're righteous. You think you're inheriting the land because of your goodness. Oh, yeah? Well, what if Moses hadn't been there? Then you wouldn't be there at all. You wouldn't be standing on the borders of Canaan. And this is underlined by the same words in terms of standing in the breach in Ezekiel. I think we won't look there. It's a slightly different context, but God says in Ezekiel 22, 30 through 31, I looked for someone to stand in the breach, and there wasn't anyone, so I destroyed them. Okay? So it's not like a hypothetical kind of thing. It is, God will pour forth his wrath if there isn't someone to mediate for us. Now, Moses cannot ultimately be that mediator. You may remember that earlier in Exodus, it's Exodus 32, 32, and the account in Exodus 32, but not here. Moses, when God said he was going to destroy them, said, well, blot me out instead. Moses was willing to take their place, which God declined his offer to do so. And there are various reasons why that would be the case. The main one is that Moses is only a type of Christ. Moses couldn't actually atone for the sins of the people. And instead, there was one servant of the Lord who was coming. And so let's turn to Isaiah 53. And that's the last point of our study. God's gracious provision of a mediator in Moses was to make us look forward to the provision of the Lord Jesus Christ, the one in whom we would have righteousness and acceptance with God. This in the Isaiah 53 is one of the famous servant of the Lord passages, and Here the suffering servant is especially highlighted, but he has won a victory. In verse 12 it says, "Therefore I will divide him," that's the suffering servant, "I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bore the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors." So you see, there's the full work of the mediator, not merely to plea with God for mercy and to provide good reasons, but to be the one who bears the wrath that we're due. He bore the sin of many, and that actually is really the focus in many ways of chapter 53 as a whole, but also then he made intercession for the transgressors. So Moses was only a small but very impressive picture of what Christ does for us. And I put up some references from the New Testament, Romans 8:34, several references in Hebrews that specifically refer to Christ as our mediator. That idea is present in many other cases. But we should reflect on the fact, to go back to the beginning and thinking about trusting in our own righteousness and thinking of how God must have been good to us because of us. If we really hear the weight of what this passage says, we'll realize that's not the case, but it is the righteousness of another, and it is one who has borne the wrath that's due to us because of our being stiff-necked and rebellious from the day that Moses knew us, and that is, of course, the Lord Jesus Christ. But it's not only the fact that he bore our sins, but he makes continual intercession for us. So that is a great comfort, isn't it? Because we still rebel against God. We still refuse to walk in his ways. And we can be reminded that God has one who pleads the best possible reasons for God to show mercy to us, which is Christ pleads his own blood, his own work on our behalf, his own righteousness and merits before the Father. And therefore, we can be assured that we have someone standing in the breach for us, and we won't be destroyed. Okay. All right. Any comments or questions? Sometime we should do a study on the mediatorial work of Christ, or intercessory work of Christ. Yes?
It's sometimes called the active obedience of Christ.
The fact that his obeying the law is counted as our righteousness is the act of obedience. Yes, that's right. Yeah, so that, the other part, well, the other aspect is called his passive obedience, and the older word of passive meaning to suffer, so he suffered on our behalf. St. Matthew's passion is the passion of Christ, is the suffering of Christ. So both of those are important, but yeah, that the fact that he obeyed the law where we didn't is a crucial part. Other comments or questions? Okay, let's close in prayer.